Good evening. President Trump said the former ambassador to Ukraine would, quote, go through some things. She told Congress she felt threatened. Now there's breaking news. New documents, including text messages, just out from the House Judiciary Committee. They add to others this week, and they further suggest that Marie Yovanovitch may have been under surveillance before her ultimate departure from Kiev. A line in one of the messages reading, quote, it's confirmed we have a person inside. That's just a portion of an exchange between an unknown sender with a Belgian number and a Trump donor and congressional candidate named Robert Hyde. And in addition to being just plain ominous, the messages cast doubt on Hyde's claim about another similar text exchange with Lev Parnas. I thought we were playing. Parnas says that he thought the whole thing was a joke. CNN's Pamela Brown has been looking at the new evidence and joining us now with details. So what are you learning from these newly released Lev Parnas documents?
Well, Anderson, these newly released text messages shed fresh light on apparent attempts to surveil the former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. They were sent between Parnas associate Robert Hyde and an unidentified number from Belgium about her movements in Ukraine. And in one message, the Belgian number sends Hyde a screenshot of an official photo of Yovanovitch writing, quote, my contacts are checking, adding, I will give you the address next week, to which Hyde replies, awesome. And then there's also this text from that same number with the address for the Ukrainian embassy. The next text sent 2 minutes later, Anderson says she has been there since Thursday, never left the embassy. So these messages indicate her movements were being tracked over the course of at least several days, adding more evidence to these texts between Hyde and Parnas about tracking Yovanovitch that Hyde claimed he was just joking around about. Now, for context, Rudy Giuliani and his associates have been pushing the president to fire Yovanovitch because they believe she was getting in the way of their efforts to dig up dirt on the Bidens. She was ultimately pulled from her post last spring when she said she was told she needed to return to the U.S. immediately because of great concerns. Now, we should note, after 48 hours of silence, Anderson, and mounting pressure to respond, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said today that the state will investigate this matter of the Ukrainian ambassador potentially being surveilled.
And we're showing images of President Trump at an event that Lev Parnas was standing next to him, talking with him. The documents also show Parnas's alleged communications with the congressional staffer.
Right. So these new documents also show these efforts by an aide to Congressman Nunes, Devin Nunes, to dig up dirt on Trump rivals. And in these newly released text messages, the Nunes aide tells Parnas he needs to gather material and conduct interviews in Ukraine in this effort to dig up dirt on the Biden, specifically Biden's role in firing a Ukrainian prosecutor. There were several exchanges on this matter between the two men. And what makes this so significant is that they draw Nunes even further into efforts undertaken by Giuliani and his associates in Ukraine. Last month, as you'll recall, Anderson, House Democrats released phone records showing calls between Nunes and Parnas. And Nunes admitted earlier this week to speaking on the phone with a key figure in the Ukraine scandal after previously saying such a conversation would have been very unlikely.
Pamela Brown, thanks very much. Appreciate it at the White House. Whether or not senators consider this or any new evidence of the impeachment trial at all remains to be seen. Today, the number of people who will be defending the president grew by three. Clinton impeachment special counsel Kenneth Starr, his successor Robert Ray, and Alan Dershowitz, who joins us shortly. Interestingly, the president has not always had a high opinion of Starr. Listen to what he said about him during the Clinton impeachment.
I think Ken Starr is a lunatic. I really think that Ken Starr is a disaster. I hated the way the president handled it. It was a long and terrible process. I really think that Ken Starr was terrible.
Well, that's not all. Speaking to Geraldo Rivera at the time, he called Starr, quote, a total wacko. But that was then. He is certainly known to say things he doesn't mean or to change his mind. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, he was claiming to want witnesses at the Senate trial.
When it's fair, and it will be fair in the Senate, I would love to have Mike Pompeo. I'd love to have Mick. I'd love to have Rick Perry and many other people testify.
As of now, no witnesses will be called. Alan Dershowitz joins us now. He's professor emeritus at Harvard University, a former member of the O.J. Simpson legal defense team, and a best-selling author. His latest book is titled The Case Against Removing Trump. Also joining us, another best-selling author and our chief legal analyst, Jeffrey Toobin, and a former student of Professor Dershowitz's. Professor, so what exactly is your role here? You're going to be delivering arguments on behalf of the president on the Senate floor, talking about the Constitution. You say you're not a formal part of the legal team. How so?
Well, I've been asked to prepare and deliver the case, the constitutional case against impeachment that benefits the president. It's the same argument I would have made if Hillary Clinton had gotten elected and she were being impeached. It's similar to the arguments I made when I testified as a witness against impeachment of Bill Clinton and when I consulted with the Bill Clinton legal team. I'm there only to argue about the constitutional criteria for impeachment, which I've written about extensively, and why these two articles don't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. I will go into the history of the formulation in the Constitution and the history of how these words came to be and leave it to others to argue the facts, to make strategic decisions about witnesses. That's not within my jurisdiction.
Wait a second. Alan, why are you playing these semantic games? Whose side are you on? I mean, you're on the part of the defense team. Why are you embarrassed?
You sound like my mother when I said I was
I look
challenging.
Like your mother, too.
Well, you wish. I said that I was defending the right of Nazis to march through Skokie. And she said to me, son, are you for the Jews or are you for the Nazis? I said, Mom, for the Constitution. She said, I'm your mother. Don't tell me that. You have to pick sides. The Jews or the Constitution. Look, or the Nazis.
That's very interesting. But what side are you on
I'm against impeachment. I'm clear about that. I think it would be unconstitutional. It would set a terrible precedent for this president to be impeached for these alleged articles of impeachment. So I feel very strongly I will make a strong argument against impeachment. But I'm not part of the regular team that will be making strategic decisions and participating in questions about whether there should be witnesses or not. That's going to be left to others.
Are you do you get paid for this? How does that work?
That hasn't been discussed. But if I were to be paid, all the money would go to charity. I will not take a single penny of payment that I would keep. Based on what I'm doing. I'm doing this because I strongly believe in the Constitution. I strongly oppose the impeachment. I worry about the weaponization of impeachment, and it can be used in other cases. I join James Madison, who was very concerned that using open-ended phrases could create a way in which Congress should have too much power over the president. I join Alexander Hamilton, who said the greatest danger is when impeachment turns on the number of votes each party can get. So I'm there to try to defend the integrity of the Constitution. Benefits President Trump in this case.
Well, listen, I think everybody should have the best defense possible in any courtroom. Jeff Toobin, what do you make of Professor Dershowitz's argument about the Constitution?
I think it's wrong. I mean, Alan's position, and I don't want to mischaracterize it, is that a president that impeachment should only apply to criminal offenses.
No, that's not my position.
Well, why don't you say what it is? Because I don't want to
mischaracterize. Okay, my position is clear that the framers said treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Other refers to matters that are close in kind. And Professor Dryb, by the way, agrees with me on this part of the analysis. So the impeachable offenses, they don't have to be specific criminal offenses, but they have to be criminal-like. They have to be like treason. They have to be like bribery.
So abuse of power is not a high crime.
No, abuse of power was one of those things that was mentioned by the framers as a reason why we need impeachment, but then rejected. It was widely discussed. It could easily have been accepted as one of the constitutional criteria.
That's
let me
not
give
true,
you another
Alan.
Example.
Let
me
give wait you a another second, example. Alan. All right, let me just talk for a second. I mean, Federalist 65, Alexander Hamilton, which you write about, he specifically says that abuse of or violation of some public trust is why is an impeachable offense, and it
makes
sense.
He doesn't say that. He says that's why we have impeachment, and that's why crimes like treason and bribery are abuses of power, and if they are abuses of power, but the criteria have to be met. Let me give you an example. Madison, in calling for impeachment, says we need to make sure that a president doesn't become incompetent. That's a good reason. But then when the criteria were debated, incompetence was not included because it was too broad. We needed to amend the Constitution to include that. If you want to include abuse of power, amend the Constitution. It won't get 10 votes in Congress because half the presidents of the United States have been accused by their political opponents of abuse of power. It's much too open-ended and too broad, and it would turn us into a parliamentary democracy in
which
Congress has too much power over the president. That's not an impeachable offense. It could have been. They discussed it, but they didn't put it in the Constitution. They put in crimes that violate the public trust. That is treason. and bribery violate the public trust.
But as you know, Alan,
they would violate the public trust.
There was no federal criminal code in the late 18th
century. That's right. That's why I say you don't need specific crimes. You need criminal-like behavior. Everybody knew what bribery was. Treason is defined in the Constitution. And if somebody, and here I disagree with Trump, if somebody were to murder somebody, by the way, we did have a vice president who did murder Alexander Hamilton while he was vice president, and he wasn't impeached because in those days, a duel, even though it was illegal, was not regarded as murder.
Jeff, Jeff talk a little bit. What do you think the scope of high crimes and misdemeanors is, and how much is open to interpretation?
Well, it is, of course, open to interpretation, like any provision of law. You know, they don't cover every circumstance. But the point of impeachment is misconduct and bad conduct that only a president can do. Alan, you and I can't withhold aid from the Ukraine to advance our political interests. Only the president has the power to abuse his power in that way. And the idea that the only remedy for that is to have an election down the line, this is so far outside what we expect of the presidency. And it is violation.
I agree with all that, but the framers didn't make it an impeachable offense, and they could easily have done it. Jeffrey, let me ask you one direct question. You admit these are arguable points. Don't you think it's important for the president to have a constitutional lawyer like me making those points in a nonpartisan way, in a way I would have been making them for Hillary Clinton, and introduce a nonpartisan constitutional element into the discussion? They can listen to your argument. Listen to mine.
I got to go to break. It's a cliffhanger. Jeff will answer that question when we come back. Also ahead tonight, one of the jurors will be listening to Professor Dershowitz. Senator Tammy Baldwin joins us. Later, more of my conversation with Lev Parnas, plus more on the new documents from House Democrats raising new questions tonight for the White House. Talk tonight about the impeachment case against the president, as well as the case against that case, the constitutional arguments for and against, the politics, as well as new documents coming to light. And to that specific point, we'll hear more from Lev Parnas shortly. Back now with Jeff Toobin and Alan Dershowitz, who right before the break asked Jeff whether the president, in fact, deserved to have a top-notch attorney, such as Alan Dershowitz, exploring constitutional questions and issues during the trial. What about that, Jeff?
He absolutely is entitled to the best constitutional defense he can get. What he's not entitled to is Alan pretending like he's some sort of neutral observer instead of what he is, which is Donald Trump's lawyer. For some reason, you don't want to admit that, and that's up to you. But you are pretending that there is some sort of perfect constitutional sweet spot. It doesn't have to be a crime, but it can't be simply being a bad president, that there is some magical area in there that is an impeachable offense. And I think, straightforwardly, that abuse of power, it's the framers recognized it. That's what's the issue in this case. And the senators are perfectly capable of determining whether what the president did is a violation of his oath.
Well, that's like saying a judge is perfectly capable of determining something without an advocate on any side. Look, let me be clear. I'm an advocate. I'm an advocate against impeachment. But I'm politically neutral. That is, I would make the same argument if it was a Democrat or a Republican. I don't let my political preferences interfere with my constitutional analysis. Look, Jeffrey, it would be good if you presented your argument on behalf of the Democrats. You're a partisan on that side. They would hear arguments from you. They would hear arguments from me. But I think the Senate and the country are helped when they hear from somebody like me, who is a liberal Democrat, who has always voted Democrat, who has strong views on impeachment. I had strong views even when Nixon was impeached. Although I favored his impeachment, I urged the ACLU not to take a position, but instead to defend his civil liberties when he was named as an unindicted co-conspirator. I took the same position when Bill Clinton was impeached. I'm taking the same position now. I think it's very valuable for the Senate to hear that kind of point of view and then let it make its decision.
But I wish we had a nonpartisan, I would do this for Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton didn't behave this way.
I would do it for Hillary Clinton If she did behave this
well,
way.
If she did behave this way. We're into, like, magical hypotheticals
I'm just
here.
Saying, no, I'm just saying I'm not partisan. I don't take my cases based on whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. I pass the shoe on the other foot test. No matter what it is, if the same facts were for a Democrat or Republican, I would make the same arguments. I don't think that's true of all of my colleagues or of all of the folks on CNN.
Well, I can't, or answer, any, I can't
or,
speak
or
for anyone
Fox
but
anybody
myself.
Else.
All I'm talking about is the facts. Here and the rule in the Constitution. And the rule in the Constitution, which I have always understood and which I think is by far the majority view, notwithstanding your view, is that abuse of power, a president doing something that is not a violation of the criminal law, but a serious and, you know, threatening use of presidential power, that's exactly why we have a
high crime. That's why they should hear your view and my view. The framers agreed with my view, not yours. They could easily have put abuse of power into the criteria for impeachment. It was discussed. It was never accepted. Let the Senate hear our points of view, but don't criticize stating my position and don't say, I've changed, Jeffrey.
Well,
I've been completely consistent since 1973. I have changed not at all. Well, the big rap on me is that I don't change,
well,
that I have a small mind. I'm the hobgoblin of small minds because I'm so consistent.
I
but
think you
I
have a very
never
big
changed
mind.
My views but, on impeachment.
But I'm just some guy on cable. You are going into the United States Senate and telling the senators how to vote. That, to me, is a very big deal. And what bothers me is that you are doing that, pretending like you're some sort of outside objective observer instead of Donald Trump's
impeachment.
Lawyer. You keep, why don't you even want to say his name? You keep saying, it's like, that's who you are.
I am
you're his
not
lawyer.
Part of the strategic legal team. I am a constitutional analyst. I want the impeachment to fail.
But
I
wasn't,
hope it will
just,
fail.
Just for the record, it wasn't the Constitution who called you up and asked you to do this. It was the White House.
No, obviously. First of all, I've been writing about it and making this point on your show and others since well before anybody on the other side called me. I think it's the right thing to do. I would be doing it no matter what the circumstances
I have no
were.
Issue. I think everybody, I mean, as I said, I think everybody should have the best defense possible. Jeff's point is you're working for the president.
Working for the Constitution. The beneficiary this time happens to be the president. Last time it was President Clinton. The time before it was President Nixon.
I
am not working for anybody. What I'm doing is making a constitutional argument on behalf of President Trump's team against impeachment. Let's
Professor,
be very clear about that. I'm against impeachment. I think it would be a very bad thing to happen. I'm very happy that the Senate will hear my view. Let me tell you what my goal is.
Do you think there should be witnesses?
I want to persuade some Democrats. I want to persuade, and if I can't persuade Democrats to agree with me, I will have failed, and I suspect I will fail. I don't think I'll persuade Democrats, but I want Democrats with open minds to be persuaded, and it would be very nice if Republicans with open minds would hear both sides. I would love to see a real trial that really involved people who hadn't made
with witnesses?
Any
well,
kind
yeah,
of
so predetermination. That's my question. Do you believe there should be witnesses if you want a real
if
trial?
If there are witnesses for one side, there have to be witnesses for the other side.
Sure.
You can't have witnesses only
okay.
for
so, so
the
do you think there should be witnesses?
You would have witnesses for the defense. It's up to the Senate. I would have no objection if after the opening arguments and closing arguments, the Senate voted to have witnesses.
But do you think there should be? Because, I mean, your argument is you're
you,
arguing for the Constitution
I have
just
no problem.
As an outside observer because you're not on the legal team.
The Constitution doesn't speak to that. If they do call Bolton, then we have constitutional issues because Bolton will want to testify. The president will invoke executive privilege. It will probably have to go to court. And it will result in just the kind of delays
what about
in the trial
Parnas?
That the Democrats did not. Oh, if let me tell you, if I were a lawyer, a real lawyer, I couldn't hope for somebody better than Lev Parnas to be testifying against my client. You couldn't imagine anybody who would be more open to effective cross-examination than a Lev Parnas. So
why is that?
I predict here Lev Parnas will not be called as a witness because he has so much baggage and so much liability. I don't think he'll ever be called as a witness.
If he's such a terrible...
I think Bolton might be called, but he might not ever end up testifying because it's not his decision whether to testify.
But, Professor, what
does
it say...
It's the decision of the courts.
Right. What does it say that Rudy Giuliani and, according to Lev Parnas, President Trump we're relying on Lev Parnas to be the face of this extortion scheme or this foreign policy scheme or this just
it
whatever
It says
scheme.
There should be an investigation, and if there is any criminal conduct, it should be charged. It also may lead people to decide to vote one way rather than another, but that doesn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense, and it's not even charged as part of the impeachable offenses. So, you know, we can disagree and agree. There's a lot we'll agree about. We'll agree about what went on with Lev Parnas and all of those people is very, very disagreeable. But you have to ask a distinction between political sins, crimes, and impeachable offenses. And those are the distinctions I want to keep in the forefront. I'm going to make my argument. I'm not telling the Senate what to do. I am presenting an argument. I hope they accept my argument.
I guess
my goal would be to get some Democrats to accept my argument. I would love to see more bipartisanism in the impeachment process,
so,
as both Hamilton and Madison wanted.
Because I'm not a law student at all, correct me where I'm wrong here, but it says high crimes and misdemeanors in the Constitution, yes?
Yes.
Does it spell out what a high crime and misdemeanor is?
No, it spells out what treason is.
So why are you alleging that you know what a high crime and misdemeanor is?
Because I've gone back and I've read all the debates, I've read the history, and I've read the words of the Constitution.
So you're interpreting the history.
It doesn't say
that.
And I'm presenting an interpretation. You've left out one word. It says other high crimes and misdemeanors. The other referring back to bribery and treason, and high crimes and misdemeanors has a meaning. We all agree about what high crimes mean. Clinton was wrongly impeached because he committed a low crime, not a high crime.
Does everybody
Alexander, know? Come on,
Alan. What's a high crime? What's a high crime?
Yeah, you know,
a crime is a crime like treason and bribery committed by a person.
What does that mean?
In a high position.
What does that mean? Like
extortion,
treason and bribery.
Extortion.
Isn't this extortion?
If it is, then it should have been charged. There's nothing in the articles of impeachment that charge extortion.
Wouldn't extortion be an abuse
of
power?
No, abuse of power is not extortion. You aren't a lawyer, I can tell.
No, I'm not.
Abuse of power is not extortion.
Thank God.
Extortion requires specific elements. And if any of those crimes were to be charged, the House of Representatives had a duty to do it. And then the Senate would vote on extortion instead of voting on abuse of power.
Jeff,
now they have to vote up or down on extortion.
Alan,
that's not a constitutional offense.
You're mixing and matching modern concepts and old concepts. You're saying, well, he has to meet all the elements of extortion. There was no such crime on the books. This idea that, you know, you say it doesn't have to be a crime, but then anytime you mention anything other than a crime, you say that's not good enough. And
what I'm saying is
that this is why we have 100 jurors, 100 juror-like people in the Senate.
No, they're judges, not jurors, according to the Chief Justice.
So what?
I mean,
whatever you call them, they are people in whom the founders have put their trust.
Okay.
That they will make
you a
the
question,
judgment.
Jeffrey, let me ask you a hard question. What if the House impeached and the Senate voted to remove on grounds that he had committed maladministration? Now, maladministration sounds like an abuse of office.
I know. I've read the debates too.
They explicitly rejected
that.
That's my point. And they implicitly rejected abuse of power because they discussed it and didn't put it in the Constitution.
But wait, how do you know they implicitly rejected it?
Yeah, that's not
because
true.
Maladministration is not
the same as abuse of power. Maladministration is not, what it says you.
It's very close. Bad administration, maladministration, abuse of power. When you abuse power, you're guilty of maladministration. When you engage in maladministration, the point is the framers didn't want open-ended criteria capable of being weaponized for partisan political purposes by people who had more votes than the other side. Look, I'm going to present these arguments. I will be questioned about it. I'll be asked all these questions. My only point is don't criticize me, as some have done, for agreeing to play this role. I think it's an important role. This is a historic event. I'm honored to have been asked to play it. I will play it fairly. I will play it in a dignified way.
For the record,
present my argument and then let the Senate
criticizing.
Listen.
It wasn't me.
No,
just for the record.
I would want you
on my defense.
I mean, one thing I certainly learned from you in criminal law class is that every lawyer should represent unpopular clients or popular clients, and you should never criticize a lawyer for taking on an unpopular cause. However, they shouldn't pretend that they're not representing the client.
Yeah, well, let's just pause for 1 second.
I am opposed to the removal, and that's my position.
I got to get another break in. We're going to continue. If we can, we'll just continue this one more
sure.
one more block. We're just going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We are talking to Jeff Toobin and Alan Dershowitz, Professor Dershowitz. It's the latest addition to a group of now seven advocates who will be arguing on the president's behalf. What many have in common, they appear a lot on television and also in Professor Dershowitz's case has a long and illustrious career defending people of all different points of view. To that point, Professor Dershowitz, do you think, when you look at the president's, the three names named today, yourself, Ken Starr and Robert Ray, do you think the president picks people in part because of how they defend him on TV?
I don't know. I was surprised that he selected the two prosecutors, special prosecutors, in the Clinton case.
Right. Because they've been popping up, obviously, here on CNN, but also on Fox News.
They both argued that abuse of power is a constitutionally permissible criteria for impeachment. So we will have some disagreement about that. I'll tell you where we won't have any disagreement, and that's on the second article, and that is obstruction of Congress. The idea that a president can be impeached for simply telling the executive authorities not to submit to legislative subpoenas that are issued that he believes in a partisan manner without getting the courts to order that, that's simply part of our system of checks and balances, and it's so dangerous. And
Alan,
it doesn't appear anywhere in the Constitution. There was no discussion of it in the Constitution. It's just a made-up charge, obstruction of Congress. The president they could easily have gone to court and gotten a ruling on whether a Bolton, who was the national security advisor, can be compelled to disclose conversations
Alan,
between himself and the
you're
president.
You're distorting what's in the second article. The second article is not about a single example of the president not producing a witness or
a
document. Let me finish. It is not about a single example or even two examples.
I agree.
It is about the president of the United States saying to Congress, I will not cooperate with any subpoenas for any documents or any individuals. And
unless
that
the court
is,
makes me.
No, but I mean, you know, just to say, you know, I don't think a president has the right to say to another coordinate branch of government, I won't do anything unless the courts force me to do it. The respect guaranteed among the three branches of government.
And read Federalist Paper number 78, where Hamilton specifically says that the courts are there to serve as umpires between the executive and the legislative branch. When the legislative branch does something that the president regards as utterly political and improper, whether he's right or wrong about it, and he says, look, let the courts decide, that can't be an obstruction of Congress. That can't be an impeachable offense. All he's doing is saying, I want a legal response to this. And if the courts say I have to comply, I will comply. He's not the first president to have done that.
He did it in a blanket way. And
perfectly permissible.
So that this, and remember what this whole controversy is about. This is about the attempting to control the outcome of the 2020 election. So the position the president is taking is like, well, take months and months in court so I can continue doing what I'm doing until the election happens. I don't
think
Jeffrey,
you know as well as I do that courts, when they're told that this involves the impeachment of a president, we want a ruling this week on whether or not Bolton can be made to invoke executive privilege, they would have gotten a very quick ruling. Now, it took them a month to send the articles of impeachment.
But that's not true.
Look, Alan, again, there are facts here. Judge Richard Leon, who was the judge in the Kupperman case, which is the case with the deputy national security advisor, he didn't even schedule a hearing for 3 weeks. I mean, he was lazy and incompetent.
Blame that on the courts.
Well, that's right. But I mean, the House of Representatives shouldn't be held hostage to the courts when the president is issuing blanket denials of their rights as a coordinate branch of government.
I, as a criminal defense lawyer, if my client, somebody's asked to come and testify and I claim this lawyer-client privilege, I will invoke a blanket, say, no, he's not going into court. You get a court order. Now, the House used to have a way of enforcing their own orders. They have a little cell in the basement. They haven't used that in years. Now they go to the courts. It may take time. That's part of our system of checks and balances. Our government wasn't created for its efficiency. I know, but the impeachment has to be based on an impeachable offense, not on something made up like obstruction of Congress. Where do you find obstruction of Congress? It's not in the criminal statutes. It's not in the Constitution. It's just made up out of whole cloth. And it would be extremely dangerous if that went forward. I'm very happy to make the argument against abuse of power. Now, when we get back to abuse of power rather than obstruction of Congress, Congress considered a lot of words. They considered peculation. That was a reason why we should have impeachment. They said dishonesty, malpractice, abuse of power. All of those were reasons we should have impeachment. None of them were ultimately decided upon as grounds for impeachment. There's a big difference for why you need to have impeachment, because there you don't have to balance it against anything. But when you come up with the grounds, you're worried about Congress abusing its power. So you have to strike a balance. And the balance was struck with those four words, those four concepts. Treason, bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors.
You have an interpretation of those
four words.
I do,
and I'm going to present it.
You're acting as if you're, when I was your student, you represented Klaus von Bülow brilliantly in the Rhode Island Supreme Court, and you got his conviction overturned. Were you representing Klaus von Bülow or the Constitution?
In that case, Klaus von Bülow. I was directly.
And so why is that different from
because from... here he has seven or eight lawyers. Each of us have different roles. My role is to present the constitutional case. I am not going to be involved in the discussions about tactics or witnesses. That's not part of my role. My role is to make the constitutional argument, and that constitutional argument is being made against impeachment, and the beneficiary of that is going to be Donald Trump if I prevail. I hope to get some Democrats on board.
Professor Dershowitz, I appreciate your time. Jeff Toobin as well.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to talk to one of the jurors in the impeachment trial, Senator Tammy Baldwin. Her take on what we just heard, plus the news we reported at the top, more documents suggesting the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, may have been under surveillance. We just heard from Alan Dershowitz, who's speaking before the Senate on the president's behalf and the Constitution. One element Democrats may be interested in presenting. It's our breaking news this evening. More documents suggesting that Marie Yovanovitch may have been under surveillance before she was recalled as U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. As we reported earlier, texts released by House Democrats show an American associate of Lev Parnas, a guy named Robert Hyde, texting a Belgian number. That person or person sent Hyde a photo of former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Yovanovitch, and says they'll give Hyde her address next week. Hyde responds, quote, awesome. Joining me now is Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, who's a juror in the impeachment trial. Senator Baldwin, thanks for being with us. I'm wondering what your reaction is to this new material that House Democrats released tonight from Lev Parnas, more communications about alleged surveillance of former U.S. ambassador Yovanovitch.
Well, obviously, there's been a lot of discussion since the House Intelligence Committee started releasing some of the documents that he had shared with the committee. And I think it should be considered among the pieces of evidence that I hope we'll get a chance to review. You know, we're anxious to have a full, fair, and honest trial. And as you know, there's still an ongoing dispute about whether there will be any witnesses or any opportunities to view documentary evidence. And frankly, I don't know how it can be a full, fair, and honest trial unless we get those opportunities. This has sort of heightened the interviews that Lev Parnas has done has sort of heightened the interest in getting that sort of information before the Senate. But it also points back to our strong need to hear from the four witnesses that we have been pushing for now for weeks. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton, Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, and Robert Blair and Michael Duffy, who are both high-ranking White House officials with firsthand direct knowledge of all the president's conduct that's being alleged in these articles of impeachment.
The one of the things that Professor Dershowitz was saying was if you know Democrats get the witnesses they want to have, that Republicans should be able to have witnesses as well. And there's been indications from some Republicans that they would like to have, you know, Hunter Biden or Vice President Biden. Does that make sense to you?
Well, the articles are very specific. Abuse of power, referring, of course, to the president soliciting foreign assistance to for his personal benefit and political benefit in the upcoming election, and obstruction of Congress. And I know you've discussed those articles. I have no idea what relevant and firsthand information somebody like Hunter Biden could provide that would provide any clarity on the two articles of impeachment. And so, you know, I don't see a reason why they would want to bring a witness like that forward, given what we're listening to and what we want to get to the bottom of. But, you know, right now we don't have any witnesses. And I am going to be pressing as hard as I can, and hopefully joined by several Republicans so that we can have a real trial, a full trial, and an honest trial.
Do you think that there are enough Republicans to want that? I mean, I've heard estimates of anywhere from 3 to 4 would be needed.
You know, there's a new tally every day. It strikes me that just a week ago, Mitch McConnell was saying that he had the votes of the Republican caucus to not allow witnesses. But I think that there will probably be more than one debate about witnesses when we convene on Tuesday. And I think when we do, it will be as solemn and serious as the day we had yesterday when we were sworn in as essentially senators sitting as jurors. I think we'll have a debate on the conduct of the trial. And it may not be the last word. I do know that our leader, Chuck Schumer, will have the opportunity to amend any motion or resolution that Mitch McConnell brings forward about the conduct of the trial. I expect us to debate, and I certainly hope enough of my Republican colleagues want to hear from John Bolton, want to hear from Mick Mulvaney and Robert Blair and all of these witnesses, Michael Duffy, who have firsthand direct knowledge of the president's conduct that's being alleged. And frankly, you know, I assume that the president may want to bring witnesses. This is a time where he can present his case, and he chose really not to during the House impeachment inquiry. And, you know, that's the president's choice. But I think that it would, you know, behoove him, now that he has his full legal team announced, to be thinking about the case that he's going to present.
Senator Tammy Baldwin, I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you.
I appreciate yours. Thanks.
Senator, thanks. Coming up, allegations the president called the nation's top military commanders a, quote, bunch of dopes and babies. Details ahead. It's a meeting that's been reported on many times, but new details about it, if true, are quite extraordinary and disturbing. The high-level meeting took place in July of 2017 between President Trump and his top military chiefs. A new book written by two Washington Post reporters details the meeting. It's titled A Very Stable Genius, the book, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. According to the authors, the meeting's goal was to educate the president on what was felt were gaping holes in his knowledge of history. But the tutorial reportedly devolved very quickly. In an excerpt published today, they write that as the meeting wore on, the president lashed out at the military brass, saying, quote, you're a bunch of dopes and babies. He also reportedly said to them, you're all losers. You don't know how to win anymore. In the meeting's aftermath, then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was reported to have called President Trump a bleeping moron. Joining us now is former Defense Secretary William Cohen. Secretary Cohen, I read this section of this new book, and though this has been reported on in the past in other books and articles, the new details on this are particularly troubling. And the whole thing is really, I got to say, it was frightening to read the level of the inability of the president to concentrate and to actually sort of understand what he was being talked to about.
Well, again, I haven't read the book. I read just a brief excerpt of the book, and it is demeaning to every person who wears the nation's uniform. For President Trump, as Commander-in-Chief, to say that Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Joe Dunford, are babies or sissies or incompetent. It's stunning that he would say that. As someone who has not worn the uniform himself, I think you need to take care and pay the appropriate respect to the people who have. The other thing that's in the book is that he is turning our military. In his mind, we are a mercenary organization, our military.
Yeah, it's all about making money. He wants everybody to pay for American troops to go places. He wants to take, I mean, this ludicrous idea of taking other countries' oil, which is something he talked about during the campaign. And I mean, I talked to him about it and, you know, thought it was just insane at the time. And, you know, a violation of it, just every, you know, we're not Vikings like trying to pillage a country.
The notion that anyone joins up to serve our country is in it for the money is absurd. He is obsessed with making money. In fact, one of the excerpts, he said, if you were running a private company, you'd go bankrupt. Well, there's a supreme irony since he has gone bankrupt on several occasions.
Yes.
But the Pentagon, the Defense Department, is not run as a private entity, a profit-making enterprise. It is organized and funded in order to protect our national security. And we are deployed globally, not as a favor to any other country. We deploy to those countries that share our interests and our ideals. And that protects our national security. And in his mind, what we have to do is bring everybody home and let everybody else fend for themselves. That is a very Darwinian world in which I think we are inviting conflict on a massive scale. So our people have been deployed honorably and without compensation that anywhere that nears what he has in mind in terms of a business operation. And they're willing to sacrifice life and limb on our behalf. I just entertained the youngest living Medal of Honor recipient, Carl Carpenter, who fell on a hand grenade in order to protect his comrades, had his body blown apart and pieced back together over years. This young man was not doing it in order to make money. He was doing it in order to protect his comrades and his country. And for the president to suggest that bunch of sissies, bunch of incompetence, it really betrays the notion of our military, the service that the men and women render to this country. And as Commander-in-Chief, I think he has an obligation to instill pride, respect for their patriotism and sacrifice. He does anything but that when he goes in to the Pentagon or in the Situation Room and says you're a bunch of incompetents, you're losers, you've never won anything. Well, they've been in the blood and the mud, and they fought in that on behalf of the country. I have four-star generals in my office, and I know these are the proudest people I have met with, the most patriotic, and I would fight beside them any time. And the president said he wouldn't have any one of them fight with him. I would say I'll take them any day of the week as opposed to the commander-in-chief.
Yeah, I mean, like the president knows what it is to fight anywhere. The other thing was honorable about the people in the room at the time, the military personnel, is especially the lower ranking officers who were on the side of the room in this briefing. They just, you know, they sat there listening to what the president was saying and, you know, some, according to the reporter who did this book, some thought about walking out, but they sat there, you know, they put their heads down. They just continued to do their jobs despite what the president was saying.
They are trained to obey the chain of command. The president of the United States sits at the top of that chain. And so by their culture and tradition and obligation, they are there not to challenge the president and to criticize him on his very first meeting, but to rather listen to what he has to say, to listen to his response to what their briefing is, rather than be demeaned. So I don't fault them for that. And according to the book, it was Secretary of State Tillerson who raised the issue. Mr. President, you can't talk that way.
Secretary William Cohen, I appreciate your time. Thank you. News continues. I want to hand over to Chris for Cuomo Primetime.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.